This episode of Agalia Chats is brought to you by WPE WebKit, a port of the WebKit web engine that's optimized for Linux embedded devices with a focus on performance, hardware acceleration, flexibility, and having a low memory and storage footprint. Visit WPEWebKit.org to learn more about it and find out how you can collaborate with the project upstream.
Okay, hi, I'm Brian Cardell. I'm a developer advocate at Agalia.
And I'm Eric Meyer, also a developer advocate at Agalia. It's interop time.
Yeah, it's that time again.
Yep.
We thought we would talk about interop, the close of 25 and the beginning of 2026. And yep. maybe just a little bit the project in general.
Just as a quick summary for people who maybe haven't paid attention to interop. The way it generally works is in the late summer to early fall, the interop group opens up a call for proposals from the community. Anyone can propose, hey, this is a thing that I think should be an interop, right? So it could be MathML, or it could be this one specific part of a JavaScript API that nobody has implemented or only one browser has implemented or whatever. And so a bunch of proposals come in, and then that period is closed, and then the interop group works through that list. And so anything that like doesn't have tests, that gets dropped, because interop is very much about measuring progress and interoperability, and we use web platform tests to sort of gauge that. So if, like you said, so if Chrome is passing a bunch of tests, but nobody else is implemented that, so they're not passing any tests, then that has a very low interoperability score, as opposed to maybe everyone has implemented half of a specification, but if they've all implemented the same half, that could actually be a higher interoperability score. Still not a very good one, but it would be higher. Anyway, so, you know, things that are speculative tend not to make it into interop. So, you know, someone might say, hey, this new spec is being finished up, you should put that on. But it's like, right, but the spec's not done. And it's without a spec that's in relatively solid shape and without tests, it's probably not going to go forward. And then it has to get winnowed down even further just based on what the teams are willing to commit to do, right? Because all these browser companies, all these companies have browser teams, where the browser teams do not get anywhere close to really an even noticeable percentage of the revenue of those companies. And right. So they have constraints. They have resource limitations. They cannot just say, yeah, we'll just hire enough engineers to do all of this. So,
and they all have different personnel, which is easy to forget, right? Like, yep. So it's easy to forget that, you know, these three people are out on parental leave, and this person is dealing with, you know, this person is the one person who is our super expert with XYZ and would be able to do that very efficiently. And they're, you know, dealing with
on sabbatical
with their partner. Yeah, right. Exactly. Yep. They're on sabbatical. They're whatever. We're in the middle of a major rewrite of our whatever, you know, we are currently. There's so many things that go into like, what is the state of a project that like, even literally if they all started from the same, like if everything was a fork of the same project 10 years ago, but had different budgets and different going forward, like it would slowly drift to where those were completely different propositions.
Yeah, absolutely. So it gets, the list gets narrowed down.
It gets winnowed down, not just based on your resources, but based on, you know, all the signals that we can find. It go in as an input to that too, right? So,
right.
So to an extent, we go in with a sort of like a, hey, this is our sort of wish list of things, right? Like this is what we think from our perspective, all the inputs that we can find, this would be the most valuable stuff to prioritize. Now let's see what we can agree can be prioritized. And to that point, it has to have, you know, tests, and we need to be able to find a plausible way to get it done.
And it has to be a thing that, you know, none of the browser makers have said, we're not doing that for whatever reason. Like, there are some proposals that get dropped because one or another of the browser makers has said, we're not going to do that for security reasons, for whatever reasons. Like, so anyway, a lot of this is playing catch up with Chromium. It's true. And part of it is that Chrome is the R&D arm of the web to a certain extent, but it's also, I think, because of that community input from the developer point of view, it's like, well, Chromium lets us do all of these things. And other browsers have not necessarily shipped all of those things. And, you know, some people would say that's because Google incentivizes their engineers to ship new things. Others would say, well, they just have a much bigger budget, so they are able to try more things out. So there is a fair amount of that.
And it is, like, not completely that way. Like, there are things where, you know, both Firefox and Safari are getting 66.6%. And Chrome and Edge score zero, you know, the media classes, the media pseudo classes and that were taken up. So those are like playing and those kind of things, right? There's like the play state and some timing related thing, sound state. So for whatever reason, those were prioritized in those other engines, maybe because they were easier to do in their architectures. Like, who knows why, right?
Right. So, and that actually, one of the things that is where Chrome needs to catch up is JPEG XL, which was selected as an investigation area this year. It's in. For the last few years, people have asked for it, and it's never gotten into interop, which has made some people very upset. But it's in this year as an investigation area, not as a focus area. The goal of an investigation area is to eventually get something to be a focus area. But the problem is JPEG XL doesn't really have that many web platform tests, and the tests are not as wide-ranging as they should be. So the investigation area actually has a roadmap of tests to create and put into web platform tests. And then ideally, next year, it could be a focus area, or even more ideally, by the end of this year, because the tests are there, there's no need to put it in interop because it's already interop. So we'll see how that turns out, right? But that was... that was how it was included this year. So, and just as we were getting ready to launch Interop 2026, a Rust implementation actually did land in Chrome behind a flag. So you can, if you enable the flag in Canary, I think, maybe also in the stable, I don't remember now, you could actually display JPEG XL in Chrome if you've enabled this flag, but it's not on for everybody. So it's not ready for production. This is what browser makers do when they're trying out new code, is they put it on behind a flag. People who are interested can check it out. Hopefully, if there are any bugs, they're found, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, and things can stay behind a flag for a while. But anyway, that was sort of the big shift from previous years. Sort of an example of, here's a thing that people kept proposing, and it kept not being picked, but this year it's in this investigation way. That's one of the four investigation areas, and at least two of them, I think. Is it two of them? It's kind of all of them. We're not sure how to test these things, so we're going to investigate to see if we can figure it out. Mobile testing is one of them. Accessibility testing is another. You can do some mobile and accessibility tests. in an automated way, but the really important tests, it's very hard to figure out how to do in an automated way. So yeah, it'll be looked into, but you know, who knows how those will turn out. The JPEG XL is much more sort of defined. Like I said, literally there's already been written a roadmap of these are the tests that need to be created. Someone just needs to create them. And then maybe we'll figure out that we need more, but this is sort of the minimum. Yeah. When it comes to mobile testing, you know, there's just questions like, how are you supposed to do automated testing of orientation, you know, landscape versus portrait, or any of the gyroscope APIs or whatever? Like, it's just, those are really hard questions. So, there was also WebVTT. Apparently it's inconsistent and it needs better tests. So that's the last of the four investigation areas.
Time, text. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. For video and and for audio too, I think. Right. I'm not sure.
I think so.
Okay.
I think it's just media in general. Yeah. And then there's another sort of bucket, which is called web compat, where there are three things that kind of went in there. Module loading in ESM, taking the WebKit prefix off of user select as part of web compat, and the timing of scroll events relative to animation events, because the exact timing of where like scroll and animation events occur in relation to each other can have a very profound effect on how scroll linked animations work and what you can read programmatically through the API. So through the DOM API. So yeah, those are sort of in there. I think the scroll events relative to animation events is one of those. We just really need to like get it nailed down that everyone is considering those things in the same way. Right. Like you could have all three engines handle, you know, fully supporting scroll events and animation events, but if they're like figuring them out in different orders, you can get different results.
Right.
It's just one of those really subtle little behind the scenes thing. But yeah, there's a bunch of, bunch of other stuff. Most of it's CSS, but I feel like that's because, you know, CSS handles the visual presentation of things. Mm-hmm. So noticing inconsistencies is much easier there than it is with, let's say, HTML parsing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I think that the CSS working group is bigger, gets a lot more funding. It definitely creates a lot more proposals.
Yeah,
there are a lot more places for things to plug in, and there are a lot of things in there that are maturing after years or even decades. A few years ago, HAS was on there, right? That originated in 1999. Was the first proposal for that. This year, I think that the CSS attribute function.
Yeah, absolutely an example of this.
So, yeah, I think there's just like a lot more raw content there. It's easier to test. And, you know, it's gotten a lot of funding over the years for stuff. So we do tend to see, I think every year, we tend to see like a fair bit of stuff that's CSS. But it's not everything. I think it's maybe about a fourth of the stuff?
I would say half. Yeah, it's 11 CSS primarily. Yeah, 11 primarily CSS areas out of 20. Now, some of those do bleed across between things. So like the custom highlights API is one that I would call like CSS custom highlights. That's kind of a CSS thing, but it's also about the API that you, so you can talk to it through the DOM. So that's kind of both CSS and JavaScript.
No, you're right. For whatever reason, we prefix these with some of them with CSS and not others. So you're right. There are some in here that I was not immediately visually grouping them, but they definitely are.
Yeah.
CSS. So yeah, it's about half.
Yeah. It's a little more than half. The rest is JavaScript. There's one primarily HTML, which is dialogue and popover, specifically additions to the dialogue element and the popover attribute. Mm-hmm. So you can do a dialogue closed by any, for example. And there's a popover equals hint that got picked. And this, again, bleeds a little bit into CSS because there's also the open pseudo class that matches anything that has an open state that could have a closed state, right? So an open dialogue can be matched using the open CSS selector, this pseudo class, but again, that needs interop work. So even though that's sort of the HTML interop focus area, it's mostly HTML and a little bit of CSS. And, you know, as we were saying, several of the CSS ones are mostly CSS, but, you know, a little bit of JavaScript. Or maybe a lot of JavaScript, depending. And then, the rest of them are JavaScript, like fetch. You can do uploads with fetch. And some kind of, there's a range header. I'm not as familiar with this sort of thing, but apparently when you're sending a fetch request, you can send some kind of a header to say, I will only accept bytes in this range.
Yeah, you can do range requests. I think that's, not that this is all it's for, but I think if you scrub a video, it can make range requests to say, this is where I'm looking for in this particular video. I don't know how interesting it is to go through all of them. Maybe we can just pick a few or just kind of rattle off some things we think are interesting, but
yeah,
I would like to, before we do that, like talk about really quickly why I really like this project.
Sure.
I don't know how many people out there can relate to this, but I know you can relate to this. When Eric and I were getting started in the web, like figuring out what actually worked in the intersection of browsers was challenging. But one thing that was really positive is that there was always news and people talking about, like, well, the next version of HTML, the next version of CSS, like, we're always looking forward to this thing that was only like a year or two on the horizon. And, you know, we had these like discrete points where there was something to that, definitely, because since then we've had people like Jen Simmons, maybe also Rachel Andrew, like, propose in CSS, like, well, we like, let's do, like, let's do CSS 4, let's do CSS 6, you know, like, let's set those sort of labels because they're really kind of useful, you know, like they're useful. So like in practice, there's only whatever is deployed and that's a living truth, you know, but putting some kind of like goal that we can commonly shoot for and a timeline, and to say like, that is what we're absolutely going to strive for that. Like we want to surpass that, but at a minimum, we really want to get to that, you know? So I feel like that's really good for the community because we can look to these things and say like, hey, we might get more stuff. I mean, not might, we will get more stuff in at least some browsers. Every browser is going to do more than this stuff, right? Maybe we'll even get more interoperable things, but at a minimum, like these are the things that we can look forward to next year. You know, like these are things that would make sense for you to invest time in learning.
Yeah. These are
things that would make sense for you to read about, to blog about, to, you know, get experience with, even if it's just playing around with it, because these are things that you will be able to turn to in the very near future. So I really like that. And the other aspect of that is that it plays a role, I think, that was similar back in the day in terms of having a common goal that you're shooting for does help you align priorities for implementers. And I think when everything is just modules and everything is moving at its own pace and everything is sort of like living standard, I feel like there was a period in there where things just got too ragged, right? Because there was not enough sort of like shared vision of priority and aim, and like we agree this is where we're spending our time. And I feel like we entered a new kind of period of developer unhappiness. So anyway, I really like that about this project. I don't know if you see those similarities or like agree with that framing at all.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I do see the similarities. It does definitely. I think at this point, because this is the sixth year of interop, so we have five previous interops. One was called Compat, but it's five previous interops. And there's a track record of by the end of each year, the things that the team agreed to work on got worked on and came up to very close to 100% interoperability. I mean, getting to pure 100% is probably an impossible challenge, but you know, getting to 99 and maybe a couple of nines is very good. And so there is that track record. There's a history of the project each year says it's going to do these things and those things get done. So we are now, yes, I think at a point where you can say, okay, by the end of the year, we should see, you know, much greater interoperability, much more consistent behavior on anchor positioning, which is one of the ones that got picked, or, you know, advanced attribute handling, which one or two browsers do already, but not everybody. So yeah, it does have that role of being able to say, oh, this is a thing that I should probably look into this year, because by next year, it will be useful to know this thing because it's going to be much more interoperable. Or for that matter, it could also serve as at the end of each year, you look at what was done and say, okay, in the coming year, I'm going to learn about this because in my situation, I actually have to wait longer than just immediately. I need to wait a year or so.
Yeah, totally.
But, yeah.
I think one of the things that, for me that I meant about that is, you know, this gets into things that we talked about. We also are involved in like the baseline and stuff like that. You know, one of the things that for me as somebody who is always, you know, like I like to see conference talks and read blogs and, you know, I follow lots of people who work for browser vendors and we work with people, you know, who have other companies where we're developing proposals and we have like an implementation in one browser and, you know, like you can easily forget what is real out there, you know. You can get way ahead of yourself. And I think that one of the things that this really gets for me is like, if it shows up in this list, that's real, right? Yeah. Like that is absolutely real. That is, there are no questions about whether that's going to happen. So yeah, I like it.
And it's a cross vendor realness. Like it's a promise from everyone involved.
Everyone, right. So. It's from everyone. So this is like, you know, not saying if you disagree with, you know, Google's not implementing something or Safari not implementing something or Firefox not implementing something that you shouldn't go complain to them and try to get them on board or whatever. Sure, go ahead, do that. But like these are real, you know what I mean? Like these are coming.
Agreed.
They're not speculative time investments, right? Like might be speculative in terms of you can't use it in a production project yet. If that's your use case, very possibly you can't. And like Eric said, maybe you want to look at them at the end of the year, but either way, it's like right. that knowledge isn't going anywhere. You know, these, right. These are important standards.
Yeah. So what were some that you really liked?
Container style queries is, I think, huge, right?
Okay.
Before we had any of this, I had this library, and Francois Remy, do you remember him? He's
yeah. on
the CSS working group.
Mm-hmm.
He and I worked on CSS custom properties. They were originally just variables, and we stressed this idea that they were custom properties and that we wanted to get this ability to kind of like observe them, and that if we could only do that, then we could do so many things, like maybe everything that you would want to do. It would be like you could use this to achieve so many things. It's 14 years since then or something like that. So
right.
Seeing it come about in kind of almost exactly the sort of way that we imagined took longer than I had hoped, but I'm excited to see that come about.
Yeah, I agree that I will find it very useful. The example that's shown in one of the blog posts, the one from WebKit actually, is exactly my use case, like my first use case. I'm sure that there will be other use cases where you can do an add container style and then in the style parentheses dash dash theme dark. So, you know, if the theme variable has been set to dark, then do these things, right? Like use the dark mode colors. I ran into this very problem on working on agalia.com where I needed to have the colors be correct, whether you're in light mode or dark mode, whether you're setting your light mode, dark mode based on your operating system preferences or your browser preferences or the little toggle that we have, right? And like, I ended up writing some patterns that I didn't really enjoy, but they work. This would have made it much easier. So yeah, looking forward to that. I'm going to push outside of my usual zone a little bit.
Oh, nice.
I am super hyped for the navigation API. Not because I'm going to use it necessarily, but because I have done like JavaScript trying to figure out history in browsers mm-hmm. in the past, and it's just such a nightmare. And the navigation API just makes all of that much cleaner, more reliable. I think for people who do need to, for whatever reason, track state, need to track history and the state of the history and maybe modify stuff and just figure out navigation where you are on the site based on whatever, like it's just going to be so much nicer.
Anchor positioning is really, really high on my list. But it was actually on 2025 and it's also on 2026. So that is a little bit hard to understand. And sure, if you were like an observer.
So that can be for a variety of reasons. So an example, and I think this applies somewhat with anchor positioning, is that in the process of becoming more interoperable, it is discovered that maybe parts of the specification aren't as clear as the spec authors thought. And so, you know, in trying to figure out, okay, there's no test for this, but here's how different people have interpreted it. Or there is a test for this, but one of the implementers profoundly disagrees that the test is even correct. And sometimes those things have to go back to the working group, and the working group will say, no, the test is correct for reasons XYZ, or, oh no, you're right. Actually, here's how it should be different. And so we're going to have to change the test. It can also be that as the interoperability gets better, and the teams are working on making that interoperability better, they find things that the spec just didn't address because nobody thought that any author would ever do such a thing. But authors are endlessly inventive in the ways that they can push various specifications. So sometimes it can be a case of, yeah, given what we've seen here, you know, given this signal that we're getting from the community, we need to make these changes. And so you get these carryovers is what we call them in interop. Anchor positioning is one of five carryovers from 2025 to 2026.
View transitions is on here. I think view transitions are really cool.
I don't know if this is technically a carryover. I can't remember now. but for those who have paid relatively close attention to the interop process, view transitions were in interop 2025. Mm-hmm. But it was only for same document view transition. So it was only like moving an element from one place to another and sort of animating that very smoothly. Mm. This year, 2026, it will include the cross-document view transitions, which I think is probably what you're excited about.
I mean, I'm excited about all of them. Like, I think sure. that, you know, they're an idea that has been around for a really long time. And they are a thing that native, you know, like we had, you could reasonably make the case that everything that we did that gave us so much JavaScript was around the fact that we really did not like the experience of the entire page going away. It felt not all like most native applications, you know? And so we built all these things to make single page apps and things like that. And we made a lot of complexity, but here, you know, with view transitions, we get these nice kind of silky smooth feeling, much more native sorts of things for very, very low discounted prices. You know? and I think they're nice. They're generally like progressive enhancements. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I just think that the design of them and everything, at least all that I've seen so far, has been really, really positive. And I'm
a good example of a way to use them. I mean, sometimes yes, you can get this whole silky smooth thing, but they kind of link pages together conceptually, mm-hmm. in a way. And I think a good example of this is DaveRupert.com, our good friend Dave from Shop Talk Show. He has a on his site, if you go to the homepage, there's his name, like there's just huge Dave. But then if you click through to one of his blog posts, it like zooms small and like scales down really quickly. The rest of the page just loads in the way that you would normally expect. Mm-hmm. But there's that link right between the two. So it doesn't feel like you've like abruptly jumped from one place to another place, yeah. even though you have.
Right.
And so that's a really good example of just a, like a light touch, low impact thing that, you know, creates this bond, this link between the two visually, where you don't have to like make the browser load the entire page and animate 600 things at once, which sure people will do. I mean, they already do it in apps.
Right.
But here, I like the way that Dave did it, where it's like, okay, just this one thing, zoom. And it doesn't take a ton of time. And it, like, if you're not paying attention to the page, you wouldn't necessarily consciously register it mm-hmm. the way that he's done it. But I think subconsciously, even, it feels more unified. So it's very cool. And yeah, that's that cross document view transition is in this year's interop. I don't know. Wondering, because last year, like I said, it was just for like same page transitions, and even that, the interop score went from nearly zero to about 90%. And I think probably some of that was, again, due to the target moving a little bit as there was a switch from single page to multi-page. This year, if you just look at view transitions, like it's starting at not quite 80%. I think the interop score is starting at 75, mm-hmm. about 75%. And so hopefully that should be very close to 100% or maybe even 100% by the end of the year.
The interop score is probably like the simplest, best thing that's happened in a really long time because it's misleading, you know, like if you have, say 10 tests and three different engines and each one passes 50% of the tests, like it's possible that no test is interoperable.
Right.
Which you wouldn't think, you know, like if you just saw like, oh, well, you know, like they're about halfway implemented, like as far as any usefulness goes, they're 0% implemented because you know nothing works the same on any of them.
Right.
So I love that score. It's the most important score. And it's a very keen measure that's like way better than anything else in web platform tests. It's an exceptionally true and fair view of what we're looking at, you know?
Yeah. And the interop score can never be higher than the lowest single implementation score.
Right.
Right. So if you have two implementations that are just 100% consistent with all the tests, and then the third comes along and it's 75%, then the interop score cannot be any higher than 75%, but it can be lower, like you said.
Yeah.
It is really weird until you actually like sit down and create a little table for yourself where you're like, okay,
yeah,
how can I make it so that every column has 5 of the 10 cells filled in, but no row has all 3 cells filled in?
And it's not hard. It's very easy with that.
Not hard at all. So, yeah, speaking of things sliding around, like we were with view transitions, there's a couple of scrolling things as well. Scroll driven animations and scroll snap are both, in there. They're separate focus areas, but they're scroll based. So I think of them as kind of the same personally, but yeah. Scroll driven animations are real interesting to get your head around. They seem super simple, and I guess conceptually they kind of are, but figuring out exactly what to do at what point is, I've done some testing and there's already, you know, a lack of interoperability even when the same things are implemented because they're, you know, slightly different timings or maybe completely different timings. But that'll get better. And then scroll snap, you know, been there for a while. But
not very interoperable currently.
Right. This is one of the ones that they actually call out. It has sort of the flexbox. It has sort of the flexbox problem, where flexbox got implemented early by a number of browsers, but at different points, and which were deeply interoperable for years. And it's the same kind of thing here with scroll snap, where, you know, there were a lot of changes. There were a lot of updates, a lot of things that seemed like a good idea at first that eventually got thrown out of the specification entirely, or completely rewritten so that the syntax was entirely different. Mm-hmm. All the things that Grid did not suffer from, but Flexbox did, and scroll snap is one of those that has suffered from that a little bit. So there's a lot of work to be done to make that interoperable so that you don't have to just say, you know what, I'm only going to support scroll snapping in this one browser, or I'm only going to support this limited set of scroll snapping that most browsers get mostly right. It'll be much closer to the ideal of, I just write my one set of scroll snap stuff, you know, rules, and all the browsers do it the way that I wanted it to.
Yeah, a few years ago, I was, Adam Argyle had made some like scrolling tab thing when we were working on tabs, and it was kind of a different model. I built a little prototype of something using the scroll step stuff when it was like much, much newer. And none of it worked today. That's terrible because, you know, I'm just linked up on my blog somewhere or something, you know, like it's just completely broken now. It's great. It's great to see that all getting lined up and everything.
Which kind of gets, it touches on when you said earlier, Chrome is sort of the web's R&D department. To a certain extent, because they have the resources and because they have the incentives, a lot of the stuff they do implement early. Right. They're willing to put that in, and it's like, hey, here's a working implementation of thing, in this case, scroll snap. And does it work the way that it's supposed to? And that then sometimes the working group will look at it and say, mostly, but not this part. So let's redo that part. And, you know, that doesn't explain every bit of interoperability, but that does sometimes happen, and Chrome can sometimes be first to these things because, yeah, they have the resources sometimes to ship an early implementation of a thing. So, I know there's one on here that I'm pretty sure that you're excited about, which is the scoped custom element registries.
We'll see, I guess. But, you know, basically what it allows you to do is within this element, register this element. So, like, you can have an XFoo element that contains an XFoo element that's a different XFoo element. And I understand why. I'm not going to argue that people don't want to do that. They do. I think that it's interesting. I'm glad that people are going to get what they want. I speculate that in practice, it will be used by very specialized use cases, and that most things will be scoped to the document, and that most people will find it more useful to follow a pattern where you define the JavaScript interface, the class, and you leave it to the importing document to define the, you know, what element name to use. That way it's like, you know, ability to namespace. You could have two buttons that are inside of one another. You can't really, don't do that. Don't put two buttons inside one another, but conceptually in terms of naming, you know, like, they could be different things, and they would just have different tag names. And I think that makes it easier to read as well, you know, because you don't assume that they're the same thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. If anyone listening is hot on WebAssembly, there's the JavaScript Promise Integration API that lets WebAssembly work in a JavaScript promise await kind of situation. You know, Agalia's done a fair amount of work with WASM and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm actually more excited about this than I am about the other one. And the reason is just because I'm keen to see what it makes possible. I know that a lot of our teammates, people on compilers, are very interested in this. And it is an interesting kind of thing because, as I understand, it basically will make it possible to take things that were written synchronously and make them able to work asynchronously. So nobody writes WASM, right? Like, nobody writes WASM. They write C or something else, and then they transpile it, you know, into WASM. And I think a lot of the things that were originally written were assumed that they would be synchronous, run in a very particular kind of model. And maybe that model isn't ideal or even possible in the web. You can't, you don't want to block the only thread, you know? I'm keen to see what happens with this. Like, I'm not down with the WASM enough to know like how big an impact this will have, but it definitely seems that the people I know who do know are excited by that.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. There was the, there's a Get All Records for IndexedDB. IndexedDB has been there for a long time, but like literally interop this year for this is just the Get All Records method because it's new ish and you can do some really cool things with it. Like query all of the records and then like batch them up or return them in the order you want. And we didn't really talk about custom highlights before, but those are in here and the custom highlights API so that you can do custom highlighting from the JavaScript side, as well as use the highlight pseudo element on the CSS side. Some pretty cool stuff. One of our colleagues here, Dallin, has done custom highlight work.
I think Steven also has done
custom highlight work. I was going to say Dallin's not the only one. But
yeah.
I just remember because Dallin is the one who did the bad apple using CSS custom highlights.
It was absolutely wild. Like we're going to link that in the show notes because if you haven't seen it, you have to see it.
Yeah.
If you don't know, the bad apple thing is frequently used to do like performancey demos in places where you wouldn't expect it, like terminal things. But seeing it done with custom highlights was pretty wild.
It's not always performancey. Sometimes it's the just. It's been said that anything that has a computer processor will eventually be used to run Doom.
Right.
And any display will eventually be used to display bad apple.
There you go.
Is what I've heard people say. And display has a very wide, like I literally saw a thing the other day where somebody took a whole bunch of like those small plastic red apples and laid them out in a grid on their floor and just arranged them to shoot every single frame.
That's wild, right? Like,
yeah.
See people who do these things where they're like projecting animations in LED lights around their house on Christmas and stuff and playing like whole movies with sound effects and stuff. It's amazing. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's in. Custom highlights are fairly new. I mean, on the scale of web standards progress, they're pretty new. And implementations have been, you know, getting better. Different browsers have been advancing at different rates, and this is supposed to bring it all together. So that'll be pretty cool.
Yeah. Web transport is in there.
Yep.
Basically it's like a HTTP 3 transport, right? Like is it quick?
Yeah. I guess you can do well. It kind of links together with another one, which was WebRTC, in that web transport lets you get very sort of high performance, low latency connections, and WebRTC, which is real time communication, depends on that sort of thing for good video conferencing or audio sharing or whatever.
Right.
Data for that matter. This is a carryover, I think, just because it didn't quite reach the threshold that the interop team likes to see. They made it to 91.6 in 2025, but really aim for higher than that. So it was a carryover in part, I think, just because of like, because in real-time communication, like settings, there are a lot of failure states and a lot of things to test for. And
So I had said, is it quick? So it is. So web transport is like the modern update to WebSockets, if you can remember that. But it's backed by HTTP/3, which was originally a Google proposal that they called Quick, QUIC. And it can be more performant than TCP. In progress in development since 2018. I remember some of this because Mark Nottingham, who was the chair of HTTP, came around 2018 and gave a really nice talk to the local meetup group that I was doing here. And he talked about some of this. So anyway, it's based on Quick, which is itself, I think, based on UDP rather than TCP, which is very interesting. Anyway, you look it up, web transport. It's pretty interesting. If you ever play with WebSockets, check out web transport.
Got it. And I think the last one I want to touch on for the historical note, the historicity of it. Sorry. The last one I want to touch on for historical reasons is the CSS Zoom property, which has been around forever. There was an Internet Explorer hack, I believe it was. Zoom 1 would fix some things. Anyway, it was just it hung around for years. And now it's been standardized.
Nice.
So it is different than just scaling things. I don't really want to get into the details of how, but you can scale just an element, or you can scale the entire document if you want, using Zoom. So I guess you're not really scaling it. You can zoom it. So let me start that over. You can zoom specific elements, just one element, the whole document, whatever. Anyway, it's a focus area.
And so, it is actually mostly interoperable at this point, except for there are some bugs associated with it. And in terms of tests, there are a handful that don't pass in Safari. So if you ever were using that and frustrated by that, be prepared to be frustrated no longer. Right. Well, yep. another year, another trip around the sun. It was my birthday this week.
So oh.
Me and Interop both one more year.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
So thanks for listening, everybody.